Welcome to Wrestling with Theology. My name is Doug Minton. I am your host. I am the pastor at Redeemer Evangelical Lutheran Church in Robbinsdale, Minnesota, as well as a lifelong wrestling fan. Wrestling with Theology wrestles with the history of pro wrestling as well as the theology of the Lutheran Church. In my humble opinion, Memphis was the best territory for wrestling, especially if you love tag team wrestling. Many of the great tag teams throughout wrestling's history either started or had a run in Memphis. In fact, many of the major stars of the 80s, 90s, and 2000s made their mark in Memphis while climbing to the national level. The biggest irritations for Memphis fans, though, especially in the early 90s, were the seemingly incessant title changes for the Southern Heavyweight title and the very obvious bookings. When you can have a rundown of a card and you know how each match is going to end days before it happens, the booking is obvious. In the mid-70s, Jerry Jarrett, the father of Jeff Jarrett, took the southern half of NWA Mid-America and created Continental Wrestling Association. The name would later be changed to Championship Wrestling Association. Not only was CWA's Saturday morning live studio wrestling show the highest rated program of any promotion in the territorial age, the CWA made a name for itself with its weekly cards on Monday nights at the Mid-South Coliseum. One of the most infamous feuds in CWA history was Andy Kaufman and Jerry Lawler. Kaufman came into Memphis in the early 80s, proclaiming himself the intergender wrestling champion. He would offer any woman in the audience $1,000 if she could beat him. Lawler came out after a while because he grew tired of Kaufman's mockery of pro wrestling. The feud culminated in a match between Kaufman and Lawler, where Lawler piledrove Kaufman twice. With pictures of him being carried out on a stretcher, the feud became a national phenomenon. Shortly after the match, Kaufman was special guest on Saturday Night Live, and both Lawler and Kaufman appeared on Late Night with David Letterman. If you want more information about these, check out the movie Man on the Moon with Jerry Lawler and Jim Carrey. It handles this part of Kaufman's life very well. Memphis was a territory for both the NWA and the AWA. Throughout the early and mid-80s, Lawler repeatedly challenged for the World Heavyweight title in each, with no success. Each of his matches against Nick Bockwinkel ended in some sort of controversy that kept the title with Bockwinkel. When he challenged Flair, all the matches ended up as draws. One of the great matches between Lawler and Flair was on the Saturday morning studio show, where Lawler got a title shot at Flair in a 10-minute time limit match on August 14, 1982. I'll have a link to the video of the match in the program notes. In 88, it looked like the AWA, CWA, and World Class would merge to form a national rival to Vince's WWF. However, that fell through after AWA's one and only pay-per-view, Super Clash 3. In 89, Jarrett bought World Class from Fritz Von Erich and merged it with CWA into the United States Wrestling Association. For a year, the USWA promoted cards centered around Memphis and Dallas until Kevin Von Erich, who was 40% owner of the company, withdrew from the USWA. In 92, USWA became the first of WWF's developmental territories. Yet in 95, the Monday Night Wars between Nitro and Raw began to show their impact on the Mid-South Coliseum cards. So USWA moved their weekly cards to Thursday nights, but that didn't help. USWA finally went out of business in November 97. Memphis's major titles throughout this run. The CWA World Heavyweight title was defended from April 79 to April 81. Billy Robinson held the title three times. The CWA World Tag Team titles were defended from July of 80 to November of 83. Don Bass and Roger Smith as the Assassins held the titles four times. The CWA Heavyweight title was the result of unifying the Southern, Mid-American, and International titles. It was in the company from December 87 to October 89. Dutch Mantel held that title three times. The CWA Tag Team titles were defended from February 88 until sometime in 90. The Bruise Brothers, Max Payne and Gary Young, and Scott Steiner and Billy Travis each held the title three times. The Southern Heavyweight title was the major singles title defended in Memphis. In all of its incarnations, it was the title most people came to Memphis to win. It was defended from 74 until 97. And then again in 2000 and 2001 and 2004 to 2010 in later incarnations of Memphis wrestling. As the main star of the promotion, Lawler held the title 57 times. Jeff Jarrett held the title 10 times. Lawler's son, Brian Christopher, held the title 26 times and is the last recorded champion. The Southern Tag Team titles were highly contested as Memphis was a hotbed for tag team wrestling. The Fabulous Ones, Stan Lane and Steve Kern, held the titles 15 times. Tojo Yamamoto, another mainstay in Memphis, held half the title 35 times with a great variety of tag team partners. Lawler held half the title 22 times. The International Heavyweight title was defended from February 83 until December 87. Austin Idol, Bill Dundee, and Jerry Lawler all held the title 4 times each. The International Tag Team titles were defended from July 85 to September 87. Tarzan Goto and Akio Sato held the titles 5 times. Bad Company, Pat Tanaka and Paul Diamond held the titles 4 times. Both members of Bad Company also had a title reign with Jeff Jarrett as their tag team partner. The USWA Unified World Heavyweight title was awarded to Jerry Lawler when he defeated Kerry Von Erich to unify the AWA and World Class World Heavyweight titles on December 13, 1988 at Super Clash 3. Throughout the USWA's run, Lawler held the title 28 times. Eddie Gilbert and Kamala tie for second most with 4 title reigns each. USWA tag team titles were awarded to Cactus Jack and Scott Braddock on August 4, 1989. PG-13, JC Ice and Wolfie D held the title 15 times. Each member of PG-13 had another title reign as well. And both Moondog Spot and Jeff Jarrett held half the titles 14 times. As the main star and one of the primary bookers, Jerry Lawler was truly the king. However, his title history goes far beyond Memphis. He was the AWA World Heavyweight Champion. Twice he was the AWA World Tag Team Champion with Bill Dundee. Southern Heavyweight title 57 times. Southern Tag Team titles 10 times. CWA World Heavyweight title. CWA International Heavyweight title 3 times. CWA Heavyweight title, different from the CWA World Heavyweight title. The CWA World Tag Team titles twice. The Mid-American Heavyweight title 3 times. The NWA Southern Heavyweight title 7 times. Memphis Championship Wrestling Southern Heavyweight title twice. Memphis Wrestling TV title once. The NWA Southern Junior Heavyweight title 5 times. The Smoky Mountain Heavyweight title twice. USWA Heavyweight title twice. USWA Texas Heavyweight title. USWA Unified World Heavyweight title 28 times. USWA World Tag Team title 6 times. World Class World Heavyweight title 3 times. World Class Texas Heavyweight title once. He was part of the Feud of the Year in 92 and 93. He was PWI's most hated wrestler in 93 and 95. But he was also the most inspirational wrestler in 88 and 2012. He was ranked highest at number 7 in 1992 in the PWI Top 500. He's ranked number 23 overall for the PWI years. And his tag team with Bill Dundee is ranked number 56 all time. I'll be back in a moment as we look at Exodus. This week we continue our Bible study through the book of Exodus, beginning in chapter 2 verse 1 of Exodus. Now a man from the house of Levi went and took as his wife a Levite woman. The woman conceived and bore a son, and when she saw that he was a fine child, she hid him 3 months. When she could hide him no longer, she took for him a basket made of bulrushes and daubed it with bitumen and pitch. She put the child in it and placed it among the reeds by the river bank. And his sister stood at a distance to know what would be done to him. These opening verses of the story of Moses bring to us many things that help us to understand the relation of Moses, especially as he becomes the leader of the children of Israel. Moses' parents were both Levites, those who would become the priestly tribe. He was considered a fine child by his mother. Now, granted, every mother thinks their newborn baby is beautiful and the greatest thing on the face of the earth. So I don't know what Moses is saying here by that he was a fine child, but something in his look held her to not want to get rid of him, like Pharaoh's edict said to the midwives in chapter 1. They hid Moses for 3 months as they tried to bypass Pharaoh's commands. But eventually it became too much. We couldn't have him crying anymore and all this, so they had to partially fulfill God or Pharaoh's command. She put him in the Nile, but in a basket that was very much like the Ark of Noah. So we have a very strong point here pointing back to Noah and the Ark as being a historic thing that the Israelites understood and knew in Egypt. That the Ark was made out of gopher wood, but also that it was covered in bitumen and pitch to seal it from the water. So Moses is floating down the river with his sister Miriam watching over him from afar. We pick up in verse 5. Now the daughter of Pharaoh came down to bathe at the river, while her young women walked beside the river. She saw the basket among the reeds and sent her servant woman, and she took it. When she opened it, she saw the child, and behold, the baby was crying. She took pity on him and said, "This is one of the Hebrews' children." Then his sister said to Pharaoh's daughter, "Shall I go and call a nurse from the Hebrew women to nurse the child for you?" And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Go." So the girl went and called the child's mother. Now here we have Moses' sister being very helpful for Pharaoh's daughter, who finds Moses among the reeds. And now here we have a thing between the different names for the people of Israel in the Old Testament. We have three names primarily. You have the Hebrews, the Israelites, and the Jews. The Hebrews point back to Noah's great-great-grandson, Eber, as being the father of those who came in through Abraham's line. The Israelites, based back on Jacob being renamed Israel and being descendants from them, and then the Jews coming from the fact that they came from Judah in the Babylonian captivity. So you have the Hebrews early on in the Pentateuch, you have the Israelites for most of the Old Testament, and then once we get to Ezra, Nehemiah, Malachi, we have Jews coming in, and then the New Testament is primarily Jews. So those are the three names for the Israelite people, how they're referred to by different nations throughout the Bible, and how each of those came to be. So in this case, it's the Hebrews, because they descended from Eber, much like the Egyptians descended from Noah's grandson, Cush. So now we pick up in verse 9, as Moses' mother comes back and comes to Pharaoh's daughter. Verse 9, and Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Take this child away and nurse him for me, and I will give you your wages." So the woman took the child and nursed him. When the child grew up, she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. She named him Moses because, she said, "I drew him out of the water." As we go through the Old Testament especially, names mean something. Names aren't just given because, well, we need a name. Names are given because there is something special about what this child is going to do. Many times it is prophetic as to what the child will do when they grow up. You can go back through Genesis and see this see this strongly in the genealogies. So now we have Moses born, and we have him grown up and brought into the court of Pharaoh. Now we get into what happens when he's an adult. Verse 11. One day when Moses had grown up, he went out to his people and looked on their burdens, and he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his people. Now, Moses never tells us how he knew that the Hebrews were his people. But sometime between when he's given back to his mother at 3 months and at this point in time in verse 11, when he's about 40 years old, he finds out that he is a Hebrew, not an Egyptian. Maybe he knew this all along. Maybe his mother told him the secret. Maybe he found out later on. Well, we're not told. And the different variations of Moses' story through film has taken it multiple different ways. So Moses sees the Egyptian beating a Hebrew. And so verse 12, he looked this way and that, and seeing no one, he struck down the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. So he rescues the Hebrew from the Egyptian slave master's beating. So then he goes out the next day. Behold, two Hebrews were struggling together. And he said to the man in the wrong, "Why do you strike your companion?" He answered, "Who made you a prince and a judge over us? Do you mean to kill me as you killed the Egyptian?" Then Moses was afraid and thought, "Surely the thing is known." When Pharaoh heard of it, he sought to kill Moses. But Moses fled from Pharaoh and stayed in the land of Midian, and he sat down by a well. Moses becomes an enemy of the state, primarily because he stood up for the Hebrews. Now, even among the Hebrews, he was not known as being a Hebrew. But then, with what the estimates are for the number of Israelites who came through the Red Sea, we're talking possibly upwards of 2 million people. And not everybody knows everything. It wasn't like today where you can get on social media and find out everything you want to know about everybody, including especially all the bad stuff. So Moses becomes an enemy of the state and runs off to Midian in the nearby Sinai Peninsula. So now we pick up in verse 16. What happens to Moses at this time? Now the priest of Midian had 7 daughters, and they came and drew water and filled the troughs to water their father's flock. The shepherds came and drove them away, but Moses stood up and saved them and watered their flock. When they came home to their father Reuel, he said, "How is it that you have come home so soon today?" They said, "An Egyptian delivered us out of the hand of the shepherds and even drew water for us and watered the flock." And he said to his daughters, "Then where is he? Why have you left the man? Call him that he may eat bread." And Moses was content to dwell with the man, and he gave Moses his daughter Zipporah. She gave birth to a son, and he called his name Gershom, for he said, "I have been a sojourner in a foreign land." In Midian, Moses becomes the protector of the priest of Midian's 7 daughters, and eventually gains one of them as his wife, who then goes on to bear him a son, whom he names Gershom, which means sojourner, as he is sojourning in a land that is not his own, even though he had just left from a land that really wasn't his in the first place. So again, names mean something. Now we finish up chapter 2 this week, verses 23 through 25. Where we hear God hears Israel's cry, remembers his covenant, and is getting ready to send somebody to deliver them. During those days, the king of Egypt died, and the people of Israel groaned because of their slavery and cried out for help. Their cry for rescue from slavery came up to God, and God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. God saw the people of Israel, and God knew. Very important words. We don't see the importance in English, but the words here talk about his remembering his covenant, his promise to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob, especially the promise to Abraham that his descendants would be in Egypt in slavery for 400 years, but then be brought out. And now it was time. The king of Egypt was dead, whether it was Moses' adopted grandfather, adopted uncle, maybe even adopted brother, whatever the relation was at that time, now was the time for Moses to go back and to bring God's people out of Egypt, to bring them out of slavery, so that they could have the blessings of God in and from the promised land. We'll get to that next month as we see Moses at the burning bush in Exodus 3. Thank you for your time and listening to this podcast. If you'd like to hear more, go back to our archives to hear the previous episodes of Wrestling with Theology. Also hear Sunday morning sermons from Redeemer. If you are in the Twin Cities area on Sunday morning, you are welcome to join us at Redeemer Evangelical Lutheran Church at 4201 Regent Avenue North in Robbinsdale, just off of the corner of 42nd Avenue and Highway 100. Just look for Jesus blessing the travelers along the road. Our services are at 9 a.m. We have Bible study at 10:30 following the service, with coffee hour in between. We encourage you, anytime you are in the area, to join us for worship and to wrestle with theology with us.